the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey folks, Jason Bond here at Stoneville, Mississippi. We've got another installment of the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast. My usual partner, Bobby Golden's out of town this week. He and Jeff Gore are off doing some stuff. I've got Angus Ketchot and Don Cook. So we're going to talk about some late season insect issues that they're dealing with. So what's going on, fellas?
Oh, just kind of looking at a few beans. A lot of these beans are headed toward the finish line pretty quick like.
That's right. That's what we're seeing, especially on these early planted beans. Today is what, August the 8th, somewhere in that neighborhood, and we're going to probably be dropping some desiccant on from what I've seen shortly. But we're starting to get a lot of insect questions now as we start progressing in the season.
Yeah, we talked to Trent last week about desiccants on soybeans, and that episode probably coming out today. So that's, yeah, it's that time of year. Man, it's a short crop. I mean, everything just seems like it's screaming towards the finish.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, from a bugs guy's standpoint, for us, of course, the early beans, the best insecticide ever is early planting. But we got a significant amount of later planted stuff, and that's where we mainly deal with all of our issues. And that's where a lot of the questions are starting to come up right now.
When we start to think about terminating our insecticide applications, what kind of things are we considering?
Well, you mean usually for most every pest, it's R6.5 or R6 plus 7 to 10 days. You're pretty much safe. You can walk away from it. Probably the only exception to that is red-banded stink bug, which they're few and far between this year.
I hadn't heard y'all talk about them much at all this year, you know, compared with last year when they were so bad.
Well, it was – we basically had a equivalent of an Arctic winter for the south here, and they're not very cold tolerant at all, and it's just – decimated those populations.
I hear y'all mention that, and obviously we had an effect on red bandeds with a cold winter, but does that necessarily apply to all insects? I mean, I guess the ones that, you know, migrate or move in and out more wouldn't have as big an effect on.
Well, it does affect some of the migratory stuff because, I mean, that cold weather extended further south where they may typically overwinter and may have reduced populations further south that would normally move up on us. Other things like southern green stink bug is not very cold tolerant. Most of what I'm seeing as far as the few stink bugs I've seen are browns and greens, which are fairly tolerant to cold weather.
Well, what other insect species would be real susceptible to cold or not susceptible to cold?
Well, loopers are migratory. They cannot overwinter. I mean, they have to have a food source and actually feed and reproduce year-round, so this cold weather probably has pushed them further back south than normal, than they normally would be. That's why one reason we're seeing so few of those here lately, one of the reasons.
Yeah, and some of this stuff is so hard to predict. I mean, you know, we try to predict things every year based on the winter, and a lot of times we're wrong, but we do have some general things, like Don said, that we pretty much know is a fact. And, for instance, as he mentioned, southern greens and red banded are definitely affected by the winter. But interestingly enough, if you think about boll worms or corn earworms, usually behind a really cold winter is when we see the biggest flights of boll worms. And we've always kind of thought, and that it's actually playing out this year, but we've always kind of thought that the reason why is they're, of course, you know, overwintering below the soil. So they're protected unless you get a really deep freeze. And as cold as it got, it probably didn't freeze, you know, 4 inches deep in the ground in most areas. But it kills all the parasitoids out that take out that overwintering population when they get on a wild host. And I think that really played out this year with the boll worm issues that we've had.
So we would tend to have more boll worms at fall on a cold winter, whereas some of the other ones we would suppress their numbers.
Generally that's true. I mean, but again, trying to predict insects is yeah, hard to well, do. But yeah, I would say absolutely generally that is the case. But you know, when them spring hosts come out for whatever insects you're talking about, if you have a cold spring and the hosts are not doing good, you can take a warm winter and all and it can all go out the window. Or you can take a really good spring host crop of ditch banks and everything else, and just a few come out over the winter and they can magnify greatly. So there are some caveats to these rules.
And we see that obviously to a much lesser degree, but with weeds, you know, some tend to proliferate more in cold winters and others in warmer winters. Yeah. And, you know, so we have different problems, especially in burn down, depending on what kind of weather we have during the spring.
Moving toward harvest, like us, we mentioned earlier, these earlier planted beans, they're either real close, they're anywhere from between being right at R6 to past R6.5. So most of those are pretty much out of the woods based on the insect populations that we're seeing now. I mean, they're pretty much to the point to get the combine ready and get ready to drop a desking in there, because they're 7 to 10 days, 12 days away. And it's unlikely, from at least what I'm seeing and what Angus has told me he's seeing, us to have a major blow up of something that's going to really hammer yield.
Yeah, and one of the things that we're going to probably focus probably the most on today is probably stink bug management. And right now, I mean, stink bugs, they prefer to be in beans that are filling pods. I mean, there's no question about it. They're seed feeders by nature. So as these beans get R55 and on to R6, typically that's when our biggest populations of stink bugs are going to be in a field. And I am getting calls about that now. It's not horrible, but there are people that are well above threshold. But the species that we're dealing with right now are browns and greens.
And that doesn't worry you near as much as the red banded.
It don't worry me near as much as the red banded, and not even close.
Is that just because they're more susceptible to the insecticides? We got more insecticide options, or why are they?
They just tend to be not as damaging on a per insect basis. Okay. They will feed, and you can see the damage where they fed, but it's just not as extensive on an individual seed as say one red banded feeding on one seed, and it's going to be a whole lot worse after that feeding event.
Yeah. So is the red flag that accompanies the red banded stink bug, that would be associated more with damage than it would be difficulty in management? And I know their numbers are...
Well, it's actually both. I mean, brown stink bug has historically been more difficult to control than greens and southern greens.
Okay.
Red band is probably somewhat similar, maybe a little bit tougher. You know, yes, they are a little tougher. The other deal is they move in numbers. I mean, you don't get a few moving in. It's usually when they start coming, there's a bunch of them coming, and then the amount of damage each individual insect can cause. So it's a couple of things that make it more.
So the red banded stink bug is kind of like the Palmer amaranth of the insect world. It just overwhelms you with numbers.
Yeah, I mean, numbers wise, I mean, they get to moving out of a field that's being harvested into, say, a late field that's R5.5. You can go from 1 to 2 to 30 in 7 to 10 days, and then in that period, the way they feed and the amount of damage they cause by each one of them feeding, I mean, you can wreck a crop pretty quick. Like,
let's get back onto the greens and the browns and the southern greens. That's what we're dealing with now. So what happens at the point, you know, say I've got one field and it matures on out and we're beyond the point of being susceptible to damage there. Do they congregate in the later planted beans? I know I hear y'all, you know, real concerned about bollworms moving out of corn into cotton. Do the stink bugs do the same thing with the later beans?
Yeah, they absolutely do. I mean, you can have a field drying down, some early planted group fours, and there's going to be some stink bugs in that field. And when you start dropping desiccant or they start maturing, then they'll move to the next field. And the guy with the latest planted beans and the last green beans wins the trophy. He gets it all. But we're treating some right now. And like I said, it's not numbers are not out of control. But there's some places that they're, you know, we're well above threshold. And, you know, all these thresholds that we talk about and so forth, when you're talking about our traditional species of stink bugs, greens, browns, and southern greens, the things that we deal with in the state of Mississippi to some extent every year, I'm as comfortable with this threshold as anything, you know, that we have out there, because we have put tremendous amount of work into this, both from a yield loss standpoint and a quality standpoint. And we can talk about some of that in a little bit.
The work that you've done on thresholds, you know, I hear Jeff, you know, as late as last week at our rice field day talking about the thresholds for the rice insects. Tell folks what kind of work goes into defining a threshold, because I know just from watching y'all that's a lot of work, but I don't know if people truly appreciate, you know, this one little number that shows up in a line in your insect control guide, the volume of work that goes into deriving that number.
I don't know if this is a good analogy. It was like you spend 2 weeks working on your taxes to get one little number to know how much you owe. That's kind of an analogy of it. I mean,
I suspect everybody that's listening here understands income tax.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that probably is a good analogy.
So I mean, you know, you do all of this, these infestations at with different levels, or you find them naturally in a field, and you manipulate the levels, and you have to do this over multiple locations, multiple years. And what you end up getting is enough data to fit a line through it. And what you can do is you can estimate how much yield loss per individual insect.
Really?
Yeah. And then from that, that's the hard science out of it. And then that's what they call an economic injury level.
Okay.
Or you can actually use that to calculate an economic injury level, which is where the amount of damage and yield loss is equivalent to what it would cost to control them. And a threshold is set somewhere below that. And depending on the insect, how fast it reproduces, how fast it causes damage, how much damage it causes, and that's where we'll set them anywhere from 20 to 25% below that economic injury level. And that gives people some time to react. Say it starts raining for 3 days, airplane can't fly, you can't get a high boy in the field. We build some of that in.
I was going to ask if there was any overage associated with this.
Yeah, there's definitely some overages in there. But like you mentioned too earlier, coming up with a threshold, I mean, we don't just sit around the room and say, hey, I think we need to spray at this level. You're right, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And you got to figure out, the first thing is how much each individual insect causes damage. And that's the hard stuff. But we got about 5 years worth of research into this stink bug threshold, where we've looked at quality losses and thresholds, and we're at 9 per 25 sweeps on our traditional species, and we feel really, really good about that. So our stink bug thresholds, and that's one of the things we want to convey today, of course they can go look in our insect control guide, is 9 per 25 sweeps until you reach that R6 stage.
And is it the same for those three traditional species?
Yes, it's the same for those three, and we'll touch back on red banded here in a little while, because I just don't even count it. It's like a different critter altogether.
Right. It just happens to be a stink bug.
But yeah, one of the things that we have learned with all this work that we've conducted is once those seed, when we get to that R6 stage and those seed have fully expanded in that pod wall, and a lot of times that's when they're really moving in the field, we double our threshold. So essentially we're treating at 20 per 25 sweeps for about a 7 to 10 day period if they show up, and then we terminate sprays at R6.5. Well, all this work that we did from a quality loss, you know, dollars at the elevator, only one instance out of all of this research did we show a quality loss or a quality deduction at the elevator, and that was at a 6x threshold in 5 years worth of research.
So then what's the damage? What damage are the insects doing then?
Most of the economic damage is occurring while the seed is filling. So if they hit that
seed, it's an actual yield loss.
It's an actual yield this is with our traditional species.
Correct.
I mean, that's important.
Yeah, correct.
And you know, 2 years ago we wouldn't even have had the red banded conversation. But with our stink bugs, I've had challenged consultants, you know, they're R6 or so, even 20, 25 stink bugs, but they're going to drop a desk in 4 or 5 days. They didn't want to treat them, and I don't blame them. I told them, leave them alone, and they're worried to death about it. And I have had tons of them that did that and never saw anything at the elevator. Now, look, I'm not saying that that's always 100% of the time going to be the case, but more often than not, it is the case, unless some bad weather, hurricane, something blows in, it sits and rains on those fields forever, then the tooth damage together.
Weather. Was it 2009? Did it rain so much?
That was it.
I mean, if you get in a situation like that, our native stink bug species can kind of exacerbate that. I mean, those punctures serve as avenues for those fungal organisms to get in. They can make that worse. But, you know, if it's clear, you know, dry, no rain in the forecast,
like we had in 2017.
Right, yep. And you're fixing to drop a desking on it in 5 days, and you're at 10, 12, or 25. I'm like Angus. I'd let them ride and knock the leaves off and get ready to cut them.
Well, I mean, this year, it's been a tight crop, you know, and cuts to the budget have been going on, you know, all the way, you know, going back into the burn down, and Bobby says even further back than that, you know, back to the fall fertilization. So I guess, you know, if you can skip an application, especially at the end of the year, that's a good way to help with cash flow a little bit.
And you were talking about thresholds just a minute ago. Normally, with red banded excluded, you'll have a mixed population of several species in there at the same time, and you just kind of count them all together. If you're over, say you're over threshold and you need to treat, you'll tailor your treatment based on the predominant species. If you're mostly browns, then you need to go after them because they're a little harder to kill than the greens and the southern greens. But if you're 95% greens and southern greens, I don't think there's any need to tailor a more expensive application to take care of those few browns when you something cheaper is going to deal with all the others.
All right, so describe tailoring, guys. What so, you know, if you got different susceptibilities or different greens products work better.
Greens and southern greens, pyrethroids, just pick one, have been just super effective. If you're mostly browns, it's going to be something like red banded. You're going to have to look at bifenthrin, which has a little better activity on bugs than the other pyrethroids. The chemistry is a little different. Acephate or a combination of the two, potentially Belay.
Yeah, so I typically, and my favorite application on stink bugs is always a tank mix of acephate plus a pyrethroid. If it's just greens, like Don said, I'm fine with straight pyrethroids. But if there's browns in the field, acephate's the backbone of that. I mean, I typically look at about 60% on browns with bifenthrin, which is better than the other pyrethroids. But most people are not going to be happy with 60% control. So acephate is the backbone of a brown stink bug complex.
Let me pose this to you. You know, we talk in the herbicide world about sublethal applications and selecting for resistance. So if you do have a mixed population in your sampling, but the majority of them are greens, and so you're going to decide to apply pyrethroid, what does that pyrethroid do to the surviving brown stink bug individuals? I mean, do you have the potential for selecting resistance there?
Well, they're already pretty tolerant from the get-go, and you know, if we're especially like this year, we're probably not going to treat every acre of beans for stink bugs. I'm not too worried because I feel the percentage of the population that we're going to select is pretty small.
All right, guys, so red banded stink bug, I mean, that's the big elephant in the room that everybody talks about, worries about. Leave folks with what our status is on red banded stink bugs right now.
So as far as I know, there have been two fields sprayed this year in the state of Mississippi, and both of them have been within the last 7 days, and both of them are south of I-20. Like Don mentioned earlier, the populations have been beat way back from the winter. But, you know, apparently enough survived in some places that people are finding some here and there. So the two fields that were sprayed, one was in a soybean OVT trial in Raymond, and the other was a 90-acre commercial field in Madison where they were finding well above threshold levels. Now, again, these are the exceptions. This is not happening everywhere. Do I think we're going to spray a lot? I do not. I don't think we got them big numbers that are going to keep falling back behind them. However, if we got very late planted beans, and as these other beans start to dry down, like we talked about earlier, what few are out there are going to start moving to the greener stuff. And I do think we'll deal with them to a minor extent in some beans that are planted extremely late. To what extent yet, I don't know.
Well, listening to Trent Irby talk, it seems like, or the perception I got from him was that most of the late planted beans tend toward the northern part of the state, primarily northeast Mississippi, where they just got rocked with some weather over and over again through the spring. So does the geography of that play into it? I mean, those being further north, is that a positive deal?
I would think so. I think that would further decrease their risk of having to deal with them.
So unless we just blow some stupid numbers up on our latitude, hopefully those guys on more northern latitudes will be safe.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I have not found one yet in, you know, the Central Delta.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. The farther north, the less risk you're at. South of 82, I mean, and when I say late, I don't mean them ultra-late beans like you're referring to. I mean, those beans you're referring to are super, super late.
Yeah, I mean, July-planted beans.
Yeah, I'm more like wheat bean time and, you know, early June or mid to late June, some of those. But I just don't think we know to the extent of it yet, but it's not something that I would – lose sleep over, and we got people that lost sleep over this deal last year, but we just need to be looking and be aware, and we're going to get the message out. If we start finding them in any appreciable numbers, I think that we'll definitely let everyone know what's going on, without a doubt.
And a big percentage of the beans, at least in the Central and South Delta, got planted pretty early. Those are for sure out of the woods now. I mean,
yeah,
they're R, you know, like I said, either right at R6 or beyond R6, headed to R6.5 and R7. And I mean, if we were going to have an issue in those, we would have seen insects by now. And so far, they're just, other than those couple of isolated areas way down south, right above Jackson, it's just been one here, one there, one yonder.
And I guess the other saving grace to this thing, and we won't know until we see it, if we do have treatable populations in late planted beans, hopefully it's more of a one and done, because I don't think the big populations are out there for constant reinfestation.
Before we go, because I know this has been a huge deal for y'all this year, where are we at on boll worms? Just to give folks an idea.
So we've essentially are at the point with most of the April and early May planted cotton that we're about done with them. But even this week, I'm still getting calls about big egg lays and stuff. And a lot of that, we're past the point that we're going to have to deal with them. The late planted cotton, I mean, I'm still getting some calls about 6-7 nodes above white flower. They still got a little ways to go. And we're still seeing boll worms out there, and we're still seeing eggs. So, I mean, it's been a tough year, but we've done really good protecting this crop in cotton. And in beans, I think, for the most part, we're kind of out of the window, except for some of the later
those stuff. I mean, the early planted beans, my feelings are they're out of danger. I mean, those moths do not like going in fields with no flowers. It's just that those beans that are really late planted and still flowering have the potential for another infestation.
So we were real fortunate to have a fast moving crop this year when we had a really big populations of boll worms.
I think it saved a spray on a lot of acres. I really do.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, we won't take up any more of your time. Appreciate y'all listening. And always, if you have any questions, just give us a call and we'll get to you as soon as we can.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.